Who knows what Jay-Z, J.K. Rowling, Bill Gates and Oprah Winfrey all have in common? Okay, I will tell you then. They have all overcome failure in one shape or form to go on to gain success in their respective careers. Welcome to My Perfect Failure. Join us as we delve into the world of our perfect failures. We will interview, explore, and discuss how our perfect failures can lead us to success. Join us and tune in.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of My Perfect Failure. Today, I'm incredibly excited because we have another amazing guest for you. So, my guest today completed his pre-med studies at Weber State University, his doctoral studies at Logan University, St. Louis, and his internship in Chicago. He has more than 22 years of experience in private practice and has built two successful clinics in Utah. At the age of 19, he was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. In his quest to learn as much as he could about the condition, he felt a compelling desire to also help others who were suffering, committing to a lifelong work of helping people. He has a wife, Kristen, and proud parents of four children and two son-in-laws. He enjoys spending time with his family, with his hobbies that include traveling, scuba diving, boating, jiu-jitsu, and bike riding. He has completed over 100 triathlons, including Ironman races over the years. His travels have taken him all over the globe, where he has been a first-hand witness to extreme poverty. We're going to get into that as well. He has a deep desire to help others improve their circumstances and is driven to impact in a positive way. He has scaled back his clinical business to help establish and found Become More, where he plans on devoting the rest of his life to help alleviate extreme poverty and promote the cause Becoming More. So a very, very, very warm welcome to My Perfect Failure, Dr. Tyler Elmore. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. It's good to be back with you.
Well, it's good to pick up. This is almost like part two, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I was saying to Tyler that I should have hit the record button when we first spoke, because this would be, we'd be on our second conversation or our second recording now, but we're going to kind of go back to where we started. And you just said that you're good and you are good, but you're not good as well because you've got an injury.
Got a little injury.
What's going on? What happened?
Oh my goodness. We were out in Cambodia doing some of our work out in the villages that we work with. And I decided to go on a dirt bike ride with a couple of my Cambodian friends and my son. And they took us on this amazing dirt bike ride. It was some of the most amazing scenery, rice fields, jungle, these little small villages, and probably a six and a half, seven hour ride. And about 4.5 hours into it, I decided to find a rut in one of the dirt roads we were on, and I went right over the front of my handlebars. And long story short, I thought I'd separated my shoulder. I knew it had hurt, and I scratched my back up and my arms, but didn't seem like too crazy of an injury. I just knew my shoulder was hurting. But I thought, okay, my buddies have taken a day off of work, and we're out in the middle of nowhere. It's too pretty to stop. So I just told them I'd kind of hang out to the back and I'd catch up. And so we did another about 50 miles, 2.5 hours out in the jungle and super fun ride. And man, the shoulder was just killing me this whole time. And so we were towards the end of our trip there in Cambodia. So I had another day and a half in the country. I got back to the city and I'm like, man, I can't move this shoulder. So I went and got a brace. And for the next day, I had this little shoulder brace on and we were running around the city doing our thing, and got on the flight back home, which is about a 21, 22 hour flight. And I could get into some positions where I was pretty comfortable, but moving around, it just, man, it was killing me. But doing my little self-exam here, I'm like, I think I just separated it because I could feel the little bump there and feel some separation. So anyhow, I get home, it's like a Saturday and it's starting to loosen up a little bit. Well, I hit the clinic on Monday and I'm like, you know, I probably should x-ray this thing and just see if everything is okay. And I x-rayed it Monday morning and found out that it broke off about a two inch piece of that clavicle, and it's completely dropped down into the shoulder. So I sent the picture over to a buddy of mine, and he's like, we're going to get you in for surgery on Wednesday. So we got to put a plate in there and several screws to put it back together. So I'm going to do this recording today, and then I'm going to head off to the hospital and get my shoulder fixed.
Honored that we're doing the recording, because so this is an insight into you, really. We're going to get into you, but this is an insight into you and your extraordinary mindset and your resilience. So surgery today, and hopefully they have you right as rain. I guess there'll be a bit of convalescing, but
yeah, it should be a fairly, unless they find anything crazy in there, should be a fairly straightforward fix. Like, I should be able to work again next week. Yeah. So barring anything crazy, but I wasn't going to miss my interview with Paul.
you're too kind. You're too kind. But I'm extremely excited to have this conversation with you, because when we spoke previously, I was really taken aback by your journey and the entire journey, really. So it's pretty extraordinary. We're going to get into that now. So I was really excited to have this conversation today. So I guess where the best place to start is generally at the beginning. And I think in this instance, I'd like maybe to start at the beginning. So people can probably gauge from your accent. So you're US based.
Yes.
And I guess you had a fun childhood, and then I guess you got into college and studies and whatnot. And then at 19, something pivotal happened. But you can start where you want to start, leading up to 19 or when you were 19, whatever feels logical to you.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. So yeah, I grew up just kind of a good childhood. I was into sports and athletics, and that was kind of my life. And anyhow, when I was 19 years old, I was getting ready to move to Portugal. I was getting ready to do a mission for my church. And I started my preparation. I got all ready, starting to learn the language. And I had a couple of surgeries. I had to get my wisdom teeth and my tonsils taken out, and in preparation to get over there. And as we started to get closer to Portugal, I woke up one morning, and it was crazy, because I couldn't move my shoulder. I thought I broke my shoulder. But I was reviewing the day, and I'm thinking, okay, I was a lifeguard. I worked at the local swimming pool, and every night we would go play racquetball. And so I figured that I must have just hit the wall somehow in the heat of battle. It was late at night, and I thought, okay, probably just hit hard last night and woke up in the morning. It's pretty sore and stiff. So I didn't think a whole lot about it. And in a couple of days, sure enough, it cleared up, and I didn't have an issue for a few weeks. Well, I end up moving over to Portugal, and I would get up in the morning, and I remember I woke up and I'm like, man, I think my hand is broke. And I'm thinking, this is so weird. I've been a normal, healthy kid my whole life, and literally I couldn't move my hand. And again, I had played basketball the night before, and I thought, okay, maybe I jammed my hand, and in the heat of battle, I didn't really notice it. And in the morning, it kind of had time to swell up and do its thing. So again, I didn't think much about it, but the pain was actually, it was pretty extreme. And didn't say anything, didn't really do anything. And 2 or 3 days later, it cleared up and it was completely gone. And I thought, okay, it must have been basketball. And then a few days after that, it hit my left hand. And I remember it hit, and it, again, it felt like it was broken. I couldn't move it. I couldn't do anything. And I thought, well, I wasn't playing basketball. I wasn't doing anything the night before. This is kind of weird. Maybe I ought to go get it checked out. So I went to a doctor, and the doctor was like, well, it looks like you got some tendonitis. He said, I'm going to give you some ibuprofen. So give it a couple of days and see what happens. And I'm thinking, okay, this is kind of weird. So I went home, took the ibuprofen, did my thing. And sure enough, in a couple of days, it disappeared. And I thought, okay, well, hopefully that's it. And another week or so goes by. And then all of a sudden I get up, I can't move my knee. And I'm thinking, this is not right. Now it's starting to get weird. It's starting to get a little bit serious. And so I went back into the doctor, and he said, well, let's get some blood work. Let's see what's going on. And I went in and had a little bit of blood work done. I said, well, you know, we've got some inflammation. We got a little bit of arthritis going on in there. We're going to give you some more ibuprofen, some anti-inflammatories. We're going to see what the next few days is going to look like, or next few weeks. Well, the problem, what began to happen was my joint would swell, and then in a couple of days it would disappear, and then it would hit another joint, and it would disappear, and then it would hit another joint. It would bounce from my shoulders to my elbows, to my wrists, to my knees. And man, after a few, three more weeks of this, I went into a specialist, and the specialist took some blood work, and he said, "Holy cow, man, you got all sorts of stuff going on in here." He said, "You've got several parasites. You've got three parasites. You've got several bacterial infections. You've got rheumatoid arthritis," is what they ultimately diagnosed me with. They said, you probably need to get back to America. You need to get back home and get some treatment on this. Now, in the meantime, I had gone from about 185-pound football playing kid, and I had started to really lose weight. And in about a month and a half, almost 2 month period of time, I dropped from 185 pounds down to under 150 pounds. So I dropped almost 40 pounds. Yeah. And what had even started at that point is initially the pain would hit a joint and then it would completely dissipate and it would leave. And then it would hit another joint and it would leave. But now it was starting to hit a joint and then it wouldn't leave before it would hit the next joint. And then it would hit another joint. So by this point, my shoulders, my elbows, everything was hurting. And I had never told my parents what was going on. I just thought, I'm a young kid, it's going to get better. Well, the doctor ended up calling my parents and said, "Hey, we got to send this kid home. We're worried that he's not going to make it. He's got some serious infections. He's got some serious parasites, bacterial infections. Plus, he's got rheumatoid on top of this." They diagnosed a heart murmur, rheumatic fever. I mean, I had a whole host of diagnoses. So when I got home, I went to the head rheumatologist.
Pause you for a second. So when the doctors hit you with a tsunami of different conditions that you had, were you able to process what they're actually telling you? I'm just thinking, as a 19-year-old, it's fairly difficult to understand what everything means.
It was. And so I absolutely couldn't process it. I'm just hearing these medical terms and thinking, "Oh, come on, I'm a young guy. I'm certain I'll give me something and this will disappear and we should be good." So being able to process the severity of it, as I look back now as an adult, no, I had absolutely no idea what was about to hit me. And so I just knew that he was nervous and he thought I needed to get back home and get treatment there. They didn't really think that they had the adequate treatment in Portugal. And long story short, when I got back to the University of Utah, they freaked out. In fact, they told my parents, they said, "What in the world is going on?" They said, "He's got three parasites, 14 bacterial infections, a heart murmur, rheumatic fever, and rheumatoid." And he said, "Those infections are so bad." There were two infections that had actually gone systemic. There was a strep infection and a staph infection that had gone systemic. And that's actually, if you remember Jim Henson, the Muppet, the guy who created the Muppets, that's what he died from, was a strep infection or a staph infection. I can't remember which one, but it had gone systemic and it had ultimately killed him. So the doctors at the University of Utah said, "Another 2 or 3 weeks out there in Portugal, you probably would have been dead."
And what does that mean? What does that mean, systemic? Sorry, I'm not.
So it had gotten into the bloodstream, It had really started to shut my system down. And so that was the rheumatoid, and that was more of a chronic autoimmune condition. The strep and the staph infection was something that they were immediately concerned about, because that stuff gets in there and it can really, really do some damage. And so they said, "Hey, we got to get this stuff taken care of." And so they said, "But another 2-3 weeks and you probably would have been dead." And at this point, I'd gone from 185, I was down to about 143, 144 pounds at the time. And I used to love to lift weights. I used to be super active. And I remember going to the gym one time with a buddy, and I'm like, I gotta feel what it's like to lift weights again. And I remember putting on a 20-pound curl bar. All right, this thing is 20 pounds. I put it on my chest and I couldn't push it off my chest. And I remember my buddy leaning over and reaching under there with his pinky, and he lifted it up off my chest. He's like, "What is wrong with you, dude?" Yeah. I said, "Man, I don't know, but it's just affected everything to the point I couldn't take off my own shirt. My mom would have to take my shirt off, put my shirt on. I couldn't button a shirt." So it had gotten to the point where all of the joints, it had started to get to the point where my vision was starting to get blurred and distorted. And so we went through multiple visits and anyhow, ultimately ended up with a rheumatologist who told me, he said, listen, here's what's going on. And this is kind of where I started to realize I had to get involved and I had to learn as much about this as I could. Because up until that point, I thought, okay, they're going to give me something. I'm going to take it and I'm going to get better.
Yeah.
But I went back in and my parents were in there and this head rheumatologist said, hey, here's the deal. He said, this is what you've got. And he said, you probably got about 5 years left to live. And he said, so what's going to happen?
You're 19 when he delivered that news.
I'm 19 at this point. And he said, what's going to happen is in the next year, you're probably going to need to get both of your knees replaced. Because the knees had really started to bother me to the point where I couldn't hardly walk. I'd have to really gimp along. And he said, in 3 years, because of the medications they wanted to put me on, it's going to soften up the bones to the point where you're probably going to end up in a wheelchair. And he said, in 5 years, he said, that's about what we can expect out of this. And they wanted to put me on these hardcore medications. One of them was chemo. And in order to just take me out of or help with the discomfort. And so as we kind of went through the options, I'm thinking, well, if I'm going to die in 5 years, I don't know if I want to introduce these toxic chemicals into my system. And it's not that I'm opposed to drugs. I just felt that if I got a 5-year time sentence here or life sentence here, I'm going to try some other stuff. And I started to talk to people and one thing led to another. And I started to look into more diet and look into more nutrition. And I ran into a doctor down in Las Vegas who was really, really into the chronic and autoimmune stuff, but addressing it for more of an inside out approach where he said, listen, I don't know if I can cure you. He said, but he said, if we can work from the inside out, meaning digestion, absorption, assimilation, detoxification, if we can just try to build up your body, he said, I think that's going to give us the best chance of either extending your life or beating this. But he gave me no promises. And he said, but I'm willing to take you on and I'm willing to work with you. Now, backing up, I'd actually gone through about 14 medical opinions and they had all told me I got about 5 years. And wow. So I'm frustrated. I'm disappointed. I'm thinking, my gosh, I'm 19 and it looks like the carpet of the rest of my life just got yanked out from under me. And
so can I pause you again? So you got 14 opinions, all of those of which said that there's pretty, you've got a five year life expectancy, but you carried on, you kind of not ignored it, but you thought, actually, I can't accept this. I need to go on and look and really find somebody that maybe have a different vantage point. Was that kind of where your mindset was at?
100%. My dad's been in traditional medicine and he was just like, man, I don't want to put you on these things. But he was kind of at a loss on where do we go? And I just remember thinking, I never thought it was my time to die. I felt like this was kind of like my call to action. Like I better get in, I better get involved and I better know what's going on with myself. So backing up a little thing that I forgot to tell you, which is one of the major turning points in my life was when I got home, I was so frustrated. I just visited one of the premier rheumatologists in the state. And he told me in a year, you're getting your knees replaced, 3, you're in a wheelchair, 5, you're dead. You'll never have kids. You'll never be athletic. And I remember coming home so angry. And I went downstairs and I turned on the TV and as fate would have it, Iron Man Hawaii was on. And I remember watching this race being just totally inspired going, you know what? That's my goal. And I remember my dad going, do you remember that mom has to put your shirt on and take your shirt off? How in the world are you going to do an Ironman? And I remember joking with him saying, well, if I make my goal to walk, when I walk, that'll be it. I said, why don't I make my goal something crazy like Ironman? And he's like, okay, whatever. And kind of go, okay, think that way. That's cool.
So when you're at that point, did you really have to believe that you could do that? Or was it baby steps in your mind to get there? Or was it giant leaps?
Well, I think a little bit of it was probably ignorance. I was so young at the time. I don't think I realized that it was a critical condition, but I don't think I exactly realized how dire it was. So in my mind, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, screw you. I think I can get better. And so I think at that point, I was a little bit naive, but also at the same time, I was never, ever convinced that it was my time to die. I just wasn't. There was something inside of me that said, it's not your time to go. So let's get to work. Let's figure it out. And the other thing that happened was about a week later, it was the very first Ultimate Fighting Championship that came out. It wasn't even called the Ultimate Fighting Championship back then. It was called the Ultimate Fighting Challenge. And it was 1993. And I remember watching a guy named Hoist Gracie back in the day. I don't know if any of you are big UFC fans, but back then they had no weight rules. And you would have to fight three times during the course of the day. And it was a $50,000 purse. The winner got everything. The loser got nothing. And I remember watching this guy, and he was my size. Well, when I was healthy, my size, 180-pound guy. I remember watching him just beat these guys up that were twice his size. And I'm thinking, I told my dad, I'm like, I'm going to learn to cage fight, and I'm going to do Ironman. Those are my two goals. And so at that point, that was where I figured I've got to get involved. I've got to do as much study as I can, and I've got to just block out all the noise. So I got to find a doctor that's going to give me a little bit of hope. And so when I went down to Las Vegas, that was the guy that was the first guy that said, hey, I'm not going to give up on you. I think we might be able to help you, but I'm not going to guarantee it. So that's all I needed to hear was, we got a shot.
How did you find him?
So I found him. It was another kind of fun story. My brother happened to be dating this girl in high school, and he was up at their house and they were talking, and he had mentioned that his brother, me, was coming home from Portugal because he got sick. So her father started questioning and saying, well, what did he get sick with? And one thing led to another, and her dad had a very similar condition about 25 years previous when he was living in Australia. And so he was this big, wealthy businessman in the area. And so as he started talking to my brother, he said, hey, why don't you have your brother call me? Because I've been through some pretty serious stuff. And he said, I've got a contact down in Las Vegas that he might want to look into. Okay. And so he called me and said, hey, come up to my house. And this, thought it was going to be a 20-minute conversation, turned into a 4-hour conversation where a lot of my symptoms and what he had were very, very similar. And so he was the only person I knew that had gone through something like this, and just his stature in society, he was a pretty wealthy guy. He's like, I got the contacts for you. I can get you right in. So that's how I was introduced to the doctor down in Las Vegas.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
If your brother hadn't been dating that girl at that particular time and hadn't been at dinner or whatever they were doing at that particular time, and if that guy hadn't had those challenges, those little interconnections, so vital.
It's crazy. I go back and I think about it now, and it's kind of sobering because a lot of things had to line up to get set in order, what needed to be set in order for me to get better. But I'll tell you what, his name is Dr. Vance, Robert Vance. The guy literally saved my life. In fact, when I got into his clinic down in Las Vegas, he went through all of my blood work and he said, you know, he told this to my parents. I didn't find this out until later. He said, listen, I have been in practice for 28 years. And he said, I've had one kid sicker than your son. And that patient died. And he said, I will never let that happen again. So I actually ended up living with Dr. Vance for several weeks until he felt like I was healthy enough to travel back and forth from Utah. But he made me stay in his house. He would not keep his eye off of me. I went to work with him. I went home with him. His wife cooked for me. His family accepted me there until he felt like I could get strong enough to go back to Utah. And then what we did, I'd go back to Utah for 3 weeks, and then I'd come back to Vegas for a week. And I go back to Utah and I come back to Vegas for a week. And he did a bunch of IV treatments. He did chelation therapy. We did a bunch of biooxidative drips and hydrating drips, vitamin infused drips. And so he changed up my nutrition. I had to get rid of any gluten, dairy, refined sugars, or red meats, which for a time I was super sensitive to. And when I would eat them, they would just kick my butt. And all of the doctors back here would say, oh, there's no connection with that. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, when I eat this stuff within 30 to 60 minutes, I can't even move. So I don't care what you say, there is a connection. And so, but it took, boy, for the next 2 years, I really didn't notice a ton of change. I thought, okay, it was 2 years. And so I had to clean up.
Wow. So for 2 years, you engaged this process, but you weren't seeing any obvious improvements.
For 2 years. And the reason I think I stuck with it was the alternative was I'm dead in five. And so for two years, okay, I cleaned up my nutrition. I quit watching TV. I quit watching the news. I got rid of all of my toxic friends.
If you can explain to everybody why you quit watching the news.
I just figured, you know, all the stress, figured my body was under such stress that listening to the news and all this stuff that was going on all over the world that I had zero control over, it wasn't going to do me any good to subject myself to that kind of stress. And so Dr. Vance was just like, you know, we got to try to focus on healing. So get rid of all the extra noise. And so at that point, I got rid of the nightly news, and I'm 49 now. I still don't watch the nightly news. I just got in the habit of not doing it. Not that I'm insensitive to that kind of stuff, but I try to focus on more of the stuff that's within my circle of influence, my family and my immediate friends that I can actually have an influence over. And so for me, it was just that extra stress that my body didn't need. I needed to use everything that it had to try to get me better. And so dialed in the nutrition, and it was 2 years before I finally started to feel something. I woke up one morning. I'm like, man, I feel pretty decent. I could shake somebody's hand without wanting to cry. I could walk without a limp, and that would last for 2 or 3 days. And then it would go back for 3 or 4 days or a week. And then I would get a 2 or 3 day reprieve. But I'm sitting there thinking, hey, there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel here. And so that went on for about 2 more years. Just I had some good days, good weeks, bad days, bad weeks. But at least I had a little bit of progress that I could see. And it wasn't until almost 4 years to the day I woke up and I thought, I'm going to go for my very first jog. And I remember the funny thing about this is I had moved to St. Louis. And on my application to get into school, I divulged exactly zero of my health history. I did not tell them anything because they wouldn't let me in. So I completely, I didn't divulge any of it. And so nobody knew what was going on. But 4 years in, I remember going out for a jog. I put on these old running shoes and I remember jogging 1 mile. And I got back and I'm like, oh my gosh, it felt so good to have actually a muscle hurt. Not an arthritic type hurt. I remember just thinking, I'm sweating. I have a workout hurt. Like, this feels phenomenal. And
if I can interject slightly. So when you decided you're going to go out for the jog, were you still under medical supervision? So were you still seeing medical people at that time?
At that point, no. I would communicate with Dr. Vance and just give him some updates. But I wasn't under any more active medical care at that point, other than my own nutrition and supplementation regimen that I had been on. And then I'd go get periodic blood work to see what my SED rates were at, my inflammatory markers were. And at that point, I was starting to feel pretty good. So,
and this was four years in line with the 5 years that you were given.
Yes. Okay. So at this point, I'm like,
sweet feeling.
Yeah, at this point, I'm like, that 5 years can kiss my rear because I'm going to beat that. But, you know, the interesting thing, I think my mindset looking back on it was, okay, I'm going to treat this like a test. And whether you believe in God or whatever people believe in, I think there's a higher power out there that kept me going that said, you know what, there's something more for me. And I knew that going in. It was kind of weird. I never, ever, ever thought that I was going to die. I didn't know if I would completely beat the illness, but I never thought I was going to die. And I remember the approach that I took to it was like, okay, whenever anybody does something great, you're going to get roadblocks and you're going to have barriers. And I think God is going to test you and say, okay, how bad does this guy or gal want this? and you run into a lot of things. And so I remember my approach going into it was just how I approached a test in school. If I got a test and I know what's coming down the pipe, if I study and I learn that material, and the more I study and the more familiar I become with that material, the better chance I have of passing this test. And so I just took that from a school perspective into life and saying, okay, the more I learn about my health, the more I learn about my body, the more I use my mind to try and beat this thing, the better chance I have of ultimately winning. And again, whether or not I completely win, I don't know, but if I can certainly improve my quality of life and live a better life, that would be a win. And so I approached it like that. The more I studied, the harder I worked, the better chance I had to beat this thing.
So over that time, clearly your mindset was becoming stronger, or it was becoming more beneficial to you. You were working on that. You were using it from a, what I found very enlightening and intriguing, and I'm just in awe of for the first time we spoke, and also now, is the fact that such a young age, you were able to kind of pivot your mindset, and really you kind of understood, it appears to me, pretty quickly that you needed to change up here as well as physically. So there was a physical challenges that were clearly evident.
Yes.
But you used your mind to help yourself physically. And I found that extraordinary when we first spoke, and I still find it extraordinary now, because I'm thinking of myself as a 19-year-old. Would I have had that mental awareness, fortitude to do what you've done? I don't think I would have done. So I'm intrigued about how you got to that point.
Yeah, and I'll give credit where credit's due. I don't think I could have done it on my own. No way. I started listening. I had very supportive parents. Dr. Vance was unbelievable. And then he was very, very good in that support. And then he tuned me in, or clued me into Tony Robbins and Les Brown and some of those motivational speakers. So I would go to bed every single night listening to Les Brown, Zig Ziglar, Tony Robbins, all of these guys that would at least get my mindset built up. And I remember an interesting thing, and I believe it was Tony Robbins. He said, listen, and I learned this one early on, and I think this was the big switch for me. He said, your mind does not know the difference between a vivid thought and reality. And so if your thoughts are negative, your body is going to pick up on that, and your body is going to pick up on that negative vibe. And whatever negativity you're thinking about is ultimately going to eventuate into its physical manifestation. And so I remember taking that lesson and thinking, okay, if we only use this small portion of our mind every night, I am going to throw something good into that. And that is what I'm going to go to sleep with. I'm not going to get any of that negative stuff, because I need to be positive. And so I remember taking that lesson from Tony Robbins. And I remember every night I would go to bed and I would watch myself finish Ironman. I would watch myself do a jujitsu. I would watch myself cage fighting or whatever it was. But which was interesting, because when I finished my very first Ironman, it was almost anticlimactic, because I remember coming down the runway going, dude, I've been here a million times before. And so it was kind of nice, because when I finished, I actually finished the Ironman, but I actually had two kiddos, which was kind of fun, because they told me I wouldn't have any kids.
Okay.
But I remember coming down that finish line going, man, it's kind of weird, because this isn't new. I've done it a bunch before. And so it's kind of weird when I sat home and thought about it. I'm like, wow, that mind is a pretty powerful thing, because I've done it before. So it wasn't anything new when I finished.
Yeah, Tony Robbins would love this story. I could imagine you being in one of his stages. I think he would just sit there like me in utter silence.
Well, that guy, I'll tell you what, he probably, and he doesn't know me from Adam, but he was one of the guys that had the largest influences on my mind. So, well, he was the guy who had the largest influence on my mindset, no question.
Yeah, I think honestly, I think that he would just be in awe of the story, because 14 experts that you sought kind of gave you information that you didn't really want to hear. Mm-hmm. And when you've got that groundswell of medical experts and opinion, you know, in unison, then we can be forgiven for thinking, well, that's it. But you had something about you that thought, well, no, it's not. I need to forage on. And then obviously you get mm-hmm. to the point where you are today. But so you went for that run, you did your first mile. And then what happened after that? So you get to the point that you're starting to have children, you're starting to do an Ironmans. What happened in that in-between period?
So the in-between period, I was in school. I still had a few more years to go. So I swam a little bit. I bought an old bike that I biked a little bit on until I graduated from chiropractic school. And the day that I graduated, I was like, I'm doing Ironman. So I bought a triathlete magazine. And inside that triathlete magazine, it had a workout regimen. And it said 13 weeks to a sub 13 hour Ironman. So I'm looking at that and I go, I can do that. So I looked at the training program and I'm like, here we go, man. Let's do this. So I got on the calendar and I signed up for the Santa Rosa Full Vine Man. It was up in Northern California. It was an Ironman event. And I had 13 weeks to get ready. I went out and I bought a bike. I went out and I paid for my Ironman entry fee. I paid for airfare for my wife, my two kids, and my in-laws. So I was in about $5,500. And I'm like, I can't quit now. I spent $5,500. We're doing it. And so I used that 13 weeks to a sub 13 hour Ironman. And I started training. So we moved back to Utah. And I had started up my own private practice at that point. So I would get up at 4:30 in the morning. I would work out from 4:30 to about 8 on Monday through Thursday. And then Fridays, I would do a little bit more of a long Friday and Saturday. I would do either a long bike ride or long run. So I'd get up at 6 and I'd go from about 6 to 10 or 6 to 11. And that was my routine. So 4:30 in the morning, I'd get up and I'd swim, bike, run, or I would do a combination of the two, or whatever that 13 week to a sub 13 hour Ironman training program told me to do. And so Ironman rolls around. Well, let me back up here. I was doing my last big long run 4 weeks out from Ironman. And I'm right in front of my office heading home. I'm 16 miles into a 20 mile run. And my ankle finds the only rock in the road and I sprain it. And I go down. I land right in the middle of the street. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I sprained my ankle and I'm 4 weeks out of Ironman. So what had happened to this point is I had done two sprint distance triathlons, which those are a half mile swim, 12 and a half mile bike, and a 3.1 mile run. I had done an Olympic distance race. So that was a 1 mile swim, 6.2, or excuse me, a 25 mile bike ride, and then a 6.2 mile run. And then my plan was the next weekend, I was going to do a half an Ironman to get me ready. So I couldn't do the half Ironman because I had a sprained ankle. And so I was a little bit nervous, but I'm like, great. I got to plug forward. And so fortunately, the last 3 weeks of my training period were more of a tapering period and I couldn't run. So I would just swim and bike during those periods. Day of Ironman came along and my ankle was a little bit sore, but ended up being a non-factor in the race. It actually loosened up after I started going and it wasn't a big deal. But mentally, when I sprained it, I thought, oh my goodness, all this training and down the tube. But anyhow, ultimately finished that first Ironman and I finished it in 11 hours and 50 minutes.
11 hours. So you smashed it out of the park, even with a dodgy ankle.
So it was fun. But again, the ankle was not really a factor during the race. Yeah. Fortunately, but I was able to finish it and do quite fine. And from that point on, I fell in love with triathlon and continued to do Ironmans. And then as my family got older, I laid off the Ironman distance and did more of the sprints and Olympics because it was more conducive to family life. Ironman's a lot of training and I had proved my point. I finished one. And to me, that was the day that I knew that I kicked the illness. When I finished Ironman, that was the day I knew that I had beat it. And so.
And so I've got so many questions that are swirling in my head. So I guess the one that I guess I'd like to ask initially. So when you got to the point that you were starting to do all these Ironman, starting to think about doing Ironmans and so forth, did you think to yourself, the journey that you've been on and now that you're doing Ironmans, what were you just living your life, or did you, or could you ever take a moment just to kind of sit down and think, the journey that I've been on, everything that I've been told that I wouldn't be able to do, you were actually told that they gave you 5 years. Did you ever have those moments where you could sit down and digest everything?
Yeah, and I did, and I still do. I still try to go back and think through it. I think a lot of it in the beginning was just survival mode. So I didn't take a lot of time thinking what I had been through and that. I just thought, okay, next step. And it was so incremental that it never really felt like this huge journey to me. It just felt like, okay, it was so one step at a time that I never realized what I had really been through until probably finishing Ironman. I looked back and I was like, whoa. That's pretty cool. And then just looking back at the whole thing, I remember going, whoa, I think I did something pretty cool. But up until that point, I never really looked at it more than just day to day. I got to get up and I got to do my thing. And it really was so incremental that it didn't seem like this huge accomplishment until I did sit down later and look at it.
And just to timestamp it, so you were given the 5 years. And you did the triathlon, and you had children. What year was it from the moment that you were diagnosed to you did the triathlon?
Yes, so I did my. It was 2000. The year 2000, I did my triathlon, my first Ironman, and I was diagnosed in 1994. Yeah, 1994. Yes, or excuse me, it was the end of 1993. End of 1993, I got diagnosed.
Okay. So you're talking about No,
let me back up here. It was the end of 92, the beginning of 93 that I got diagnosed. Okay. Yes.
So you're talking 7-8 years.
Yes.
And you did a, so did you ever go back to any of the medics and say,
you should have sent them
all a picture.
So it's kind of funny because I had some pretty, I had a diabolical plan set in place, and my dad shook me out of that. He's like, Tyler, you are not going to go back there and say what you want to say. Yeah. He told me, he said, hey, you take the high road. You don't need to be a jerk. You don't need to go back in there and say anything. So I didn't. I had planned on going back to one of them who was actually not very kind to me during the process when I told him that I wasn't going to go with his protocol. In fact, he was actually really... he was a jerk.
Yeah.
And if I would have been healthy when I was in his office, I probably would have punched him. He was a jerk.
Yeah.
And my dad was just like, you know what? Is it really worth it to go back and do that? You did what you did. You've got yourself, you know what you did. The people that are close to you, the people that love you, know what you did. You don't need to go back there and do anything out of character. However, there was one incident where I ran into one of the doctors. I was out at a restaurant and one of them came by and I had known him. He was actually one of my, I don't want to give up too much information here, but he was a father of one of my childhood friends.
Okay.
And he coached me in basketball.
Yeah.
And I remember he came up to me at the restaurant. He says, hey, how's the arthritis doing? And I had finished Ironman 2 weeks previous.
Oh, really?
And I remember saying, rheumatoid? Like, no, I haven't had much of that. I said, I just finished Ironman. And he looked at me and said, wait, like Ironman, like the swim, bike, run Ironman? And I said, yeah. And he said, really? I'm like, I did. I finished it. And here's the crazy thing, because as a physician myself, if I tell somebody something or I give them some advice and it doesn't work, and I go and they go somewhere else and they get advice and it works, I know that I don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
My first question to that individual is going to be, whoa, where did you go and what did you do?
Yeah.
That never came up. He completely changed the subject and never asked me another question about it. We went off into more personal family type stuff. So I thought it was kind of interesting that he never followed up with, wow, what did you do? How did you do it?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's just like, whoa.
Yeah. Cause almost you want to sit down and actually think, well, what happened? What did you do? Because
yeah.
So just to kind of capture a little bit of that. So you're a physician now, and I'm keen to get into in a second why you chose that career. Did you learn about the relationship with, I guess, being diagnosed with something or being given bad news, and the capacity we have as individuals to rise above potentially quite devastating situations? I guess what I'm asking this in a really bad way, actually. I'm thinking from a physician's point of view, when you or physicians speak to patients, obviously from a medical perspective, you've got to give them the medical perspective. But because of your journey, how important is the mental as well? Silly question, but is that something that physicians should be looking at as well? Because clearly, from your perspective, you've pretty much achieved the miracle.
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that question, because depending on which type of patients we're dealing with, when we're dealing with a lot of our chronic and autoimmune patients who have been given a pretty crappy diagnosis, as part of the treatment plan that we put them through, a huge portion of that is mental and emotional toughness.
Oh, really? Really?
It is. And because for me, when I first got into practice, I would always tell patients, it's nutrition. Because I assumed that when somebody gets a diagnosis, they were going to respond like me. And I didn't realize that my mindset was the exception. And so I originally thought, okay, it's nutrition. As I started working with patients, I'll tell you what, I can get a pretty good beat pretty quick on who's going to do well and who isn't. Yeah. You can't tell if you're going to cure people. But when somebody comes in, some people will get a life sentence or a terrible diagnosis, and that's the excuse. They just go, oh my gosh, doctor said it, I'm done. And they quit. Their mindset is done. They've quit. I get other people that come in and go, screw that. He's not God. How can he tell me I'm going to die? Yeah. God's going to tell me when I'm going to die. So unless he comes down here and tells me face to face, I'm going to keep plugging.
Yeah.
And so there's a huge difference in patients that come in. And in fact, there's a lot of patients that I tell them they're not, when they come into my clinic, if their mindset's not correct, I won't take them on as a patient, because I know that they're just not going to do what I ask them to do, and they're not going to get the results that they need, because there has to be a huge paradigm shift. These people have to understand that they might not have all the answers right now, but the harder you work and the more you plug forward, those answers they'll be given to you. Just like people were put in my way. All of a sudden you're going to be introduced to a person who's going to introduce you to another person who's going to introduce you to something that's going to help you. And so you just have to keep plugging. But it's a good question, because mindset is huge.
Yeah. Somebody sent me something earlier in the week. It was on my phone, actually, so I can't read it out. But you just triggered a thought, and it was around luck. And I can't remember the four definitions, but there were four definitions of luck. One is that we were just in the right place at the right time. One another I think is we work towards it. So if we put the work in, then things will happen. So that's the one that I want to labor on a little bit, because if we put the work in, then things will happen. If we don't put the work in, so like in your case, it was mindset. You knew that mindset, nutrition, that had to evolve. It couldn't stay the same as a typical 18, 19 year old that would eat, drink, and do all the things that aren't particularly good for us. You knew that you had to change and evolve. And I'm guessing that that's kind of difficult. So the people that come in when they're having to maybe look at a mindset change, I'm thinking about people that we hang around with as well, family and friends. Do you have to make concessions there? There might be some friends that might be wonderful for a party, but in terms of us toeing the line in terms of our diet and whatnot, they're probably not the people need to be around, not for anything of their own, but on the mission that we're on at that particular time.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, when I was very first sick, there were a lot of toxic people that I just I couldn't be around. There were some family members that I had to really limit time with. There were friends that I had to not completely ditch as friends, but really limit the amount of time that I spent with them. And even now, older I get in more experienced in life that I get, my really, really close circle of who I hang out with, it's very intentional on who I hang out with, because I don't have time to spend an evening at a dinner table gossiping about something. I don't have the time and I don't have the desire to do that. There's so many things that need to be done that if those are the types of people that want to spend time with me, they're just going to gossip and not talk about progressing or building, or I'm not interested in hanging out.
Yeah.
I want people who are building and progressing. And I've taught my kids, the worst word that you can say in my house is the word can't. And if you say it, you're in big trouble, because it's worse than any four-letter cuss word that you can say. Is that it's not allowed. Can't, impossible. Those words are not allowed, because you don't know what you can do. And I don't mean that saying, hey, I can go jump off a building and land on my head and live. It's not like that. But so many people don't realize what they can do and how much innate capability that each one of us have. And I just think, boy, you look at people who have been really successful, and I hang out a lot. You know, the Roberts, you've interviewed them, man. When you go to lunch with them, it's exciting. It's upbeat. It's like, man, what can we do next? Who can we help next? How can we do this? They're not thinking about themselves. They're not thinking about themselves at all. They're thinking about what can we do to build it up and what can we do to help other people. And those are the people I spend my time with.
It's an important comparison as well, because it's kind of one of the reasons I do the podcast, because I think that we can be dealt difficult situations. And when that happens, we latch on to that difficult situation and it weighs us down. And sometimes we might even use it as an excuse not to experience any type of pain ever again, because our confidence may have gone and our fight may have gone a little bit or a lot in some cases. That's why I marvel at you. You understood at a pretty much instantly that I need to change. There needs to be a paradigm shift. I need to understand who I can connect with, who's going to give me that positive energy, what's going to uplift me, what's going to potentially have the opposite impact on me. And connecting with yourself and the Roberts brothers is amazing, because I can imagine being at a dinner with you guys and the energy and the even when you stumble across a problem, because we all have problems, challenges will always come up, but I can imagine you guys dissecting it and thinking, actually, we're going to work out a different scenario, and we're going to get into becoming more in a minute, because that's, I guess, a challenge that you all three of you are working on, and others. So what I wanted to ask you is around your career as a physician. Was that a direct consequence of your journey?
100%. I never wanted to get into healthcare.
Really?
My dad, no, never, ever. My dad was in hospital administration and just wasn't really my thing. I wanted to do more of a business type career, but it had a 100% impact on my desire to get into healthcare. And one of the big things was when I was going through traditional medicine, look, I love traditional medicine. I think it works phenomenal with fractures and emergencies and different things like that. But I think traditional medicine falls really short when it comes to chronic and autoimmune conditions and really learning how to take care of yourself. I didn't want to be reliant on a physician to give me a drug. I didn't want to be reliant on anybody for my healthcare other than me. And so when I decided to get into healthcare, the reason I chose more of an alternative route, the chiropractic and the nutrition route, was because I felt like that's where I could teach people to really become kind of their own physician, for lack of a better word. And when you're dealing with chronic and autoimmune conditions, no doctor is going to to be able to help you more than you can help yourself. You have to get involved because medicine is just, it's a lot of it's run by insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. And there's not a lot of stock into diet and nutrition and lifestyle change that doesn't bring the revenue in the hospital doors.
And so they don't teach you that, right? So pharmaceutical companies aren't going to teach you what we've discussed. They will, because I guess when they brand it, they have to, obviously it's a business, so they produce these products and they position it as this will have an impact on you, hopefully a positive one to a certain degree, but they don't tell you the things that are missing in terms of you, what you need to put in.
For sure. And you know, time and a place, I'll tell you, modern medicine, like today, I'm going in to get my collarbone put back together. I mean, I praise the ground. My buddy is actually putting my collarbone back together. Guy does phenomenal work. And so I praise the ground that modern medicine, I mean, they've done some marvelous things, but I still think they fall short in a lot of the lifestyle and changes that need to be made in a true healthy setting. Patients aren't taught how to live healthy. They're taught to take a drug and that's it. And I think that we need to be much more involved in our own healthcare, because nobody cares about my health, your health more than you or more than me. Yeah. And so I think we need to educate ourselves on how to live that way. And so that's what I've spent most of my life doing.
And I think that's critical to your point. I don't think we're taught how to do that. And I think from a medical perspective, or from a patient's perspective, because I don't have medical training like you, I think that because we see doctors, physicians as experts, that's why you're remarkable as well, because when you weren't a doctor, a physician or an expert, you didn't take what they said as gospel, but a lot of us do. So if we're not given this, if we're not told that, okay, this is what you need to start doing, maybe you need to take these tablets or whatever it may be, but also part of your rehabilitation is 50% is going to be up here, your mindset. This has to be you're going to have to go through a mindset shift. It will be difficult, but actually it's going to be incredibly rewarding. It's going to change your life.
Yeah. And I would even argue more than 50%.
Okay, really?
It's such a huge aspect. And I see it more and more just with patients that I deal with. If they have it up here, it's fun to watch them. All you got to do is give them the tools and they'll go out and execute. If they don't have it up here and they're not fully invested, it doesn't work and it's not going to work. They got to buy into it and they got to roll with it. And so my whole goal is to get my patients to the point where they don't need me for anything other than consultation and talk to me and tell me how they're doing. But I want to teach them what they need to know, and then they run with it and they can do it.
And like you, then I want to get on to becoming more. So in your journey as a physician, it must be incredible that you're able to give back and actually help people evolve and improve and really have a lovely quality of life, a quality of life that they deserve. Have you been wowed yourself when you've, I don't know, maybe met a patient, was in a pretty difficult situation, but they've combined sort of the mental with the medical to really transform their lives? Have you had any experience where you've been able to observe that personally?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'll give you one of my very favorite stories. It's a guy named Larry. And Larry would come into my clinic as a chiropractic patient. He had back pain. But Larry was 5'10", 406 pounds. And he was in every single week, every week. And so after months and months, we developed a relationship where I felt like, okay, I'm going to bring up the weight to him. Because he asked me one day, he said, hey, am I going to be in here every week for the rest of my life? And I said, well, it's totally up to you. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, we can work on the weight, because if we're not working on the weight and you're going to stay at this weight, yeah, you probably will, because there's nothing I can do to permanently help your back and your knees and your hips. You're too heavy. And I told him, I said, every extra pound on your body is 4 extra pounds on your joints. And I said, this is destroying these things. I said, have you considered looking into the weight loss? And you're going out on a limb, right? You know, it's kind of a touchy subject to talk to somebody about their weight. And he said, well, you know what? He said, I've been down, I've been checked. He said, my parents are obese. My sister's obese. I even went down and I got checked and I have the fat gene.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. I said, what? And he said, so I there's no way I can lose weight. So I remember a few more visits went by and I decided to be kind of a wise guy. I came into the clinic one day and I said, Larry, I said, guess what I did last week? And he goes, well, what'd you do? I said, I went down and I got checked and I got the fat gene. And he looked at me, he goes, what are you talking about? I said, I've got the fat gene. And I said, it's just not expressing itself right now. I said, but I got that gene. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, Larry, we all have that gene. And it's just a matter of whether we want that gene to be expressed. Now, I'm not taking light of the fact that he did have a very difficult time with his weight. There is a genetic predisposition for him to be overweight, but that doesn't mean that that has to eventuate. And I said, what would we need to do to get you to try to lose weight? And he's like, I can't, dude. I'm not going to do it. Anyhow, he got on an airplane. He worked for Dell Computers and he flew down to Austin, Texas. And during the course of the flight, he sits next to this lady who just becomes irate and says, so, sir, are you going to pay for half of my seat too? And they get in this argument. Stewardess comes and separates them. And he said, man, that flight, for the first half of my flight, I wanted to strangle that lady. And he said, the second half of the flight, he said, I realized that, you know, what as embarrassing as this, she's right. I'm taking up half of her seat and I shouldn't be. And he came into the clinic. He said, what do I need to do? He said, all right. So we presented him with a program and he made the goal to start running. And his story is fascinating. He was 406 pounds. We dialed in his nutrition and his first day running, he got to his mailbox. He said, that's all I could get to. And he goes, and then the second day, he said, I actually got to the first light post down the street. And he said, and the third day, I got out of my cul-de-sac. The fourth day, so fast forward 18 months. Now, mind you, Larry was on 14 different medications at the time. Fast forward 18 months. Larry, I outweigh Larry by 10 pounds now. Larry is 170 pounds. Now, this was about 16 years ago that this all started. So Larry has actually done 9 ultra marathons. He's done 9 100 mile races. He weighs 170 pounds. He's on 0 medications. And the unfortunate thing with Larry is he was out training for a 236 mile running race out by our house. And he was out on a place called Antelope Island. He got killed by a buffalo. And he's no longer with us. He beat by a buffalo. Yeah. He got, he was out running and a buffalo hit him from behind and ended up killing him. But for 16 or 15 years of his life, he was able to run around at 170 pounds. He was on 0 medications and he was able to live a phenomenal life. And it was fun. He would call me and he'd be on his cell phone in the middle of a 50 mile run up in the mountains. I mean, the guy's story was, it was my favorite story. My favorite story from practice was Larry's transition.
Yeah. And that's incredible. And it's that mindset shift. And that lady that he sat next to on the plane really gave him that shift to really go at it and actually start a new life, essentially a new life, quality of life, massive improvement.
I
think that's, a lesson to us all. So becoming more.
Yeah.
I love what you guys are doing. It'd be lovely to, obviously you've just come back from Cambodia, right?
Yes.
But for people that are unfamiliar with the story of Becoming More and what you guys are doing, maybe you can give us an overview of what Becoming More is and how you guys are helping them to alleviate themselves from extreme poverty.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, a lot of people will ask us, why Cambodia? And so I'll give you that is Wade speaks fluent Cambodian, so he's very familiar with the culture. He's been going over to Cambodia for 20 plus years and taking groups of students over there and doing a little bit of work in poverty reduction. He actually helped craft the landmine removal policy for Cambodia.
Yeah, mention that, which is incredible. That's
unbelievable. Unbelievable. So there's a connection to Cambodia. But one of the things that we realized is in Cambodia, they're very resource poor, but they're very gratitude rich. They're some of the happiest people on the planet. And then we contrast that with America, or probably even Britain. UK. You guys, we've got resources. We've got lots of resources. But on the gratitude side, we find ourselves just in the hustle and bustle, and we're angry and we're upset, and life is stressful. And so we found that our goal with Become More was to help alleviate poverty and help to create a pathway for people out of poverty and to help with development. But on the flip side of that, help with some of the Americans that are coming over to have a shift in perspective, to help gain more gratitude and thankfulness and become more fulfilled in their life. So Become More was really founded on those two principles of helping to develop Cambodians, help them to alleviate poverty, help them become very self-sufficient, and at the same time, helping Americans to have a shift, or not just Americans, Brits, anywhere, to have a shift in perspective in their life, saying, listen, I can be happy, I can be fulfilled, and I can also help other people. So that was really the premise that Become More was founded upon. The other thing that we've really tried to focus on, and I know it's a buzzword, but we've really taken it to heart, is sustainability. We don't want Cambodians to be reliant upon us. And so we've laid the groundwork there, where with our business acumen and financial help, we've been able to lay that groundwork and get them to the point where they are self-sufficient and they can do it on their own. And so we really start with a village format. All of our employees over there are Cambodian, but in a village format, what we do is we bring in all the infrastructure. We've spoken with all the locals so that they've had a big input on what we do. And then we've been able to help refine the business processes and that to help them. But what we've really tried to focus on is water, clean water. When we're talking poverty, it is so abjectly impoverished over there. It is hard to believe. Our animals over here don't live as bad as some of the people do over there. And just the basic necessities of clean water, they don't have. The number one cause, or one of the top causes of death in children over there, is diarrhea. It's because they don't have clean water. So the format that we start in is we bring in clean water for the entire village to access, and we do it around the school. We also bring in hand washing stations, toothbrushing stations. Feminine hygiene is critical over there because those poor little young girls have to miss school because they don't have anything to stop their periods with. We've also brought in English. So we have attached our English speaking programs onto their existing schools, because English, being the international language of business, shows that they can have a 50 to 100% increase in their earning potential if they can just speak English. Okay. And then one of the really exciting programs that we have over there is, we call it our Fat Cow program. We've been able to introduce animal husbandry over there, proper feeding and breeding techniques to their cattle, which has been phenomenal. So we build mini ranches that, as those things start to grow, each and every one of the village members is going to be able to have their own cattle and create their own herds. And just by simply giving them a little bit of feed in advance, there's three shots that these cows need to increase their life expectancy from about 46% all the way up to over 98%. So a lot of just little things that they haven't incorporated, we've been able to iron out those and go into these villages and be able to help create an infrastructure that is self-sustaining, so that when we're not there, and they are still rocking and rolling, they're still developing, their kids are still learning, and they're able to get themselves out of poverty. And so in a nutshell, I could go on for hours on Become More and what we're doing over there. But the nutshell is to create one village at a time, self-sustaining village, and then we're going to move on to the next and the next and the next, so that we end up getting just provinces that end up out of poverty. Yeah. And it's going well. It's going really, really well over there. I went over there to check on things, and we opened up a couple of new English schools over there, and it's been really fun.
It must be phenomenal when a what you guys are doing. But when you go back, when you go there and you engage and you coach, support all these different wonderful things that you're doing, but when you leave them to their own devices and just see how they get on there, then you can come back and just see how they picked up things that they've learned, other things they need support with. What's that like for you guys?
Oh, it's great, because we're starting to see the fruits of that right now. People are starting to learn to manage their herds. People are starting to speak English. People are now starting to get to the point where they can start to save. And that's one of the big keys in addressing extreme poverty. And I'm sure Wade probably went through this, but the definition, the World Bank definition of extreme poverty, is people living and existing on less than $1.90 per day. Yeah. And that's purchasing power parity. So that's you and I living on $1.90 a day. And so it is so fun to be able to go back and see that these people are starting to, savings is starting to take place. Now, instead of waking up in the morning and going, my hope is I can feed my family today, to, hey, we've got enough, we can get our kids through school, we can start to plan for the future, and we can start to live our lives with goals, not just, am I going to feed my family today?
It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal, really. So it's all, like we talked about, mindset shift and paradigm shifts, but obviously there's poverty, but mentally you're tooling these guys up as well, because you're giving them the capacity to use their minds and their thoughts and their wants and their needs, by the fact that you're giving them hope, the fact that you're giving them tools that they always had. But when you're born into really extreme poverty, how can you think beyond what you're exposed to, particularly when everybody else is in the same depths of extreme poverty themselves?
Yes. And that's a really good point, is like in America, we've got safety nets, we've got welfare. And this is not minimizing poverty at all, because we have it here, but we have some safety nets set into place here where you can get help if you're running into a rough time. Over there, there are no safety nets set into place. And these poor people are left, they're out high and dry. They either produce or they die. That's their choice. And the people of Cambodia, it's almost like you have to experience that culture, because they are some of the kindest, most loving people you will ever meet. And they just, it's truly a case of they don't have the opportunity. They work, they're smart, they're loving, they don't have an opportunity. And that's what Become More gives them, is that opportunity and that little step forward. But I can tell you right now, in Cambodia, I could go knock on any door in these villages we've worked in, and I could say, hey, I need a place to sleep tonight. Would you take me in? Without a question, any door that I knocked on would say, you betcha, come on in, I got you. They're that fun to work with.
Yeah. In the Western world, that clearly isn't the case. People, they would be open, or if they did, they would pretty much close it pretty quickly.
For sure. For sure.
And just from the involvement of the people that you're engaging with, and also at local, I don't know whether these people are even engaged with the local people that you're engaging with, but local businesses, local communities, local business, really, are they catching on to this? To see, because from my perspective, once you get a change in mindset from the people that you're supporting, you're helping them, but also you're helping their economy, their mm-hmm. business. So there's an upswing for everybody. So have local businesses, do they understand the opportunity that they have with their community?
Yes. And I think the longer we're there and the bigger our presence is that's, I think, the point where we're at now. Yeah. Is yes, our village, the village we're currently in, the villages that we'll be expanding to. Yes, absolutely. These people are starting to know what's going on here. And word is getting out, and people are actually getting excited, and people realize that they're going to be able to expand their businesses. Yeah. Their families are going to have more opportunities. So again, the whole goal with Become More is an absolute, it's a village-wide, it's a community-wide experience that we're looking for. And for sure, they're starting to grasp that, you know what, we can progress.
Yeah, no, I love it. So for people listening that want to know, find out more about becoming more, and maybe want to, that could be maybe they want to come out and support physically, or whether they want to donate, what's the best way for people to get involved?
Yeah, they can jump on. We got a website, becomemorecharity.org, and they can jump on that. Okay. And that gives them an overview of what we're about. And there's ways to donate there as well. And there's lots of different ways to donate. In fact, we have a lot of people who may not have physical resources to donate. They can donate time, they can donate effort. We have people that are helping us do videos and create content and different things like that. And we have other people who have lots of money, and they're donating large sums of money to help us with our work over there. So get on the website. That's probably the best way to get a good overview of it.
Okay. Tyler, I really enjoyed our discussion. I've probably overstayed my welcome in terms of easing into your time. And I know you've got your shoulder to look at, but I've really enjoyed our discussion. I always enjoy our discussions. Hopefully we'll do many more. But what I'd like to do is ask you maybe two more questions. One is maybe a question in terms of mindset and really finding that power within. Would you have any advice for anybody listening that may not even realize that they've got deeper power within that they've never accessed, but it is there? Do you have any words for anybody listening?
I would start simple and really start listening to Tony Robbins. Start reading books, some self-help books that are going to help guide you, or listen to people that are really good at that. And just start small. Go 30 minutes in the evening and just say, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to put nothing but positivity into my mind. I'm going to read nothing but positivity. I think starting small and then starting consistency. I'm going to do it 3 or 4 times a week. I'm going to get my Tony Robbins fix in. I'm going to get my Les Brown fix or my Zig Ziglar fix. Or I'm going to read one of the things that I subscribe to online, which I have for 30 years and it's free. It's the Napoleon Hill Foundation, and it's just the thought for the day. And it's all about creating that positive mindset based on Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich, which is one of my all-time favorites. Yeah. People can go on there and subscribe to a daily thought. It takes you 15 to 20 seconds to read that thought, and it's just your daily hit of motivation. And then you can build off of that, and then it will grow. It'll spiral, and more people and more resources will come their way. But I think you start small and you start consistent.
Okay, love it. I'll find a link to that and I'll put it in the show.
Yeah. And if you need it, let me know and I can send you a link to that as well.
Okay. Okay, lovely. If I can't find it, I will hit you up for that. And my last question is the recurring question. So if you could invite 3 inspirational people to dinner, alive or past, who would you invite?
Boy, there's a lot of them. But I got to tell you, I would love to have Tony Robbins to dinner. I would really love to pick that guy's brain.
Yeah.
Boy, there's a couple other. I've tried to rack my brain over that. Tony Robbins would certainly be one. I would love to speak with. I've always loved Abraham Lincoln. I would love to have that guy come back and speak with Abraham Lincoln. And another guy in the present that I would love to pick his brain is Elon Musk.
Yeah, I'm always going to say him.
I love the way that guy thinks, because I think he might have the same rule in his house. The word can't and the word impossible are probably not allowed 100%. In his place.
And it's interesting, that word calm, even when we don't say it out aloud, sometimes we say it silently to ourselves. We say it every day silently. I can't do that. That's impossible. I can't do that.
Yeah.
And every day we're preventing ourselves from achieving something that is possible. But we put these, we kind of encase ourselves in the idea that it's not possible. Mm-hmm. And I guess, like everything, over a period of time is that compound effect where we even stop asking ourselves these questions because we've said no to ourselves so many times. And that's why I love meeting you and the Roberts brothers and people like Tony Robbins and Elon Musk that you referenced, because these guys don't live in that world. They live in a world where anything is possible.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's anything is possible. I'll tell you, sitting in my meetings with the Roberts brothers, one big thing, I've learned tons from them, but one of the biggest things I've learned from them is they have fun dealing with problems. They don't go, oh my gosh, we got another problem. They're like, all right, let's bust this one out. It's a whole different world on problem solving.
Maybe that's our next episode with the three of you.
Yeah, hey, that would be a great episode, I would think.
We were discussing that before we hit the record button. So I'm writing that down. So,
and if there's one little experience I wanted to leave you with when Wade and I were out there, we were laying the groundwork in Cambodia. We had no idea what we were going to do. So we spent 2 weeks out there just getting the lay of the land and visiting people and places. And I remember as we got back on the plane ride to go home, Wade looks at me, he goes, so what did you think, man? What are your thoughts on all of this? And I said, I'm super excited. I said, but the first time in my life, I've just realized I've gone 2 weeks and I've never thought about Tyler for one second of that. My whole focus for those 2 weeks was on helping other people. It was the first time in my life where I realized I'm getting on that plane and I'm going, I forgot about me. For 2 weeks, my entire purpose was trying to help other people. And it felt so good and so liberating that I wasn't even part of that equation. I was just the physical conduit. But I didn't think about myself once.
Wow.
And that's was amazing.
And yeah, that's incredible. So it's incredible to me for a number of reasons, but one of which it shows how invested that you guys are in what you're doing, how important it is, and how special the people clearly are. The fact that when you're there, you're all totally immersed and absorbed in what you're doing, and that's so all your physical and your mental energy in a good way is focused on a really worthwhile project and what you guys are doing, and what you get from that in terms of your own is amazing as well, because you're just getting just these positive emotions and feelings, even when you're dealing with an extremely challenging set of situations. Okay.
Fun stuff.
Tyler, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise. I really
enjoyed this discussion. Definitely want to do that discussion with you and the Roberts brothers. So we definitely will make that happen. Maybe we can deliberate on exactly what we'll cover, but I think that will be a special discussion. So I'll let you negotiate for me.
I can do that.
you're closer to them than me. You can let me know how you get on. But thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hey, thank you. Pleasure was all mine.
Okay, lovely. And good luck with your shoulder. Let me know how you get on there.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into this episode of My Perfect Failure. We're always looking to grow the show, so please do share this episode far and wide, particularly if you know people that are looking to really find growth within their mindset, or they're looking to support a really worthwhile charity, Become More. And your feedback is most welcome. So we're keen to hear about things you like and equally things you don't like. So you can find me at paul@myperfectfailure.com, or you can find me via the contact page on the website. So take care for now.
Thanks for listening to My Perfect Failure podcast. Be sure to visit www.myperfectfailure.com to join the conversation. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Look out for our next episode.